internally we have that conflict of being able to convey value that it's not exactly equal to the time. There are multiple components to the professional input that goes into it. How do we still provide that optimal experience to the client where the client feels heard, but also we'll deliver the medicine to the patient who's,
yeah,
in our world, those are two separate entities.
Right.
Hey there, I am Dr. Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast, where we explore the why behind success. Every week, I meet with real estate investors, veterinary entrepreneurs, mindset coaches, authors, and fitness professionals to uncover their why and how it drives them on the winding road to success. What is your why?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast. Today, I'm here with Grace Ursary. Grace, am I saying that right? I should have asked you before I started recording.
Ursary, yeah.
Ursary. Grace is a self-proclaimed money geek. She's curious about economic indicators. Global trade is impacted by geopolitical alliances and tips and tricks on managing personal finance. Not unusual to this podcast, but what is unusual, not just to this podcast, I think, but to the world, is that you are a registered veterinary technician and certified veterinary practice manager. So I talk to a lot of people that are, you know, sort of in the finance world, real estate finance, business, that kind of thing. What I have found in my discussions is that when I talk to my veterinary colleagues, it's very, very split, very different, you know, kind of backgrounds and focuses. What was amazing when you and I first spoke was kind of just, I got really excited because we're kind of interested in a lot of the same things. That's one. Two, I think I can learn a lot from you, but like, it's just so unusual to have someone from the veterinary community to have the focus on finance that you do. And that's why I was very excited to have you on the podcast. So first, just thank you. Thanks for coming on and taking the time out today. I'm truly excited to talk
again. Yeah. It's always fun to nerd out.
I mean, there's so many things that you sort of just casually mentioned when we talked before that I was like, yes, people need to hear this. So let's just start though, with your background to talk to us about, you know, kind of, where you started, how you came into veterinary medicine and finance and how it all ties together and where you're at now.
Yeah. Veterinary medicine was definitely not my path when I was a little kid. I wasn't allowed to have a pet. So I decided to go and grab my own dog when I was at UCLA as an undergrad and defied all the rules that my parents had imposed on me. And, you know, so everybody's story starts with some animal, right? And at any age of your life. And for me, it came later in life. And I was a student and I grabbed a dog off of the West Los Angeles pound. And back then they were definitely pounds, not humane societies. And that just kind of went from pet ownership to volunteering at the Humane Society. And then it went, hey, there's a whole profession of people who take care of animals, you know, in addition to the veterinarian. And that just kind of opened up another door. And I said, okay, now I'm going to go back to school, get my RVT license. Then got into the clinical practice. That was fun. It was great. I loved the ER hours. I love my ER people. They're a funny bunch. You really have to have a really great sense of humor. And just kept on exploring like how my career would pan out in veterinary medicine. And at the time, I didn't see that there was a lot of longevity being on the treatment floor and doing, you know, cage side nursing. And so I started to look into a way to get into management. And I just got an awesome opportunity when I was at a privately owned practice and they just let me, you know, run with things because they needed help. And the more that I became involved with different practices and met more practice owners, veterinarians, technicians, it always came down to a couple of like reoccurring themes. Nobody wants to talk about money. you know, we're uncomfortable talking about it with our clients when we're presenting treatment plans. Business owners get very nervous. And I would say probably a lot of that is embarrassment, talking about finances, their business as well as their personal finances, because they've made mistakes and they just don't want to talk about it, that they're a little fearful. And that just became more and more of a space for me, because I was very comfortable, you know, asking really random questions to people. You know, I had no problems asking, hey, how much do you make, you know, or how much revenue do you generate there? Wow, that contract is really expensive. Like, how do I, like, I'm really glad my contract isn't with that particular, you know, vendor or whatever. Or how did you get, you know, such a cool price for that whole like caseload of medications and flea control and whatnot, you know? And so I think by being comfortable asking those questions, it allowed me to take on more responsibilities within the clinical practice. And from there, just one opportunity after another, being able to look at financial statements, profit and loss statements, worked with a really awesome veterinary CPA firm that was super nice about teaching. And now I'm at a point where I've learned a lot. I'm still curious about so many things. I love learning from with other people, and also from what they have made mistakes as well as successes. And I want to continue paying it forward.
Yeah, so many things to touch on there. And I think, well, first, I just, because a lot of people that listen, are not necessarily from the veterinary community. And you touched on something there that I think is probably not known outside of veterinary community, and maybe it's known if they thought about it, but not recognized. But it's the physicality of what we do. And a lot of times, especially the technicians, you know, the these dogs, 70, 80, 110, 150 pounds, they're not trained to jump up on the table and do what you want them to do.
Right.
So there have been one or two. I have had actually long ago had a family. They had three mastiffs, and they were all perfectly trained dogs, and you literally could ask them to step up onto the tables. And so, but that's not the norm, right? So the norm is they come in, they're scared. Oftentimes it's a, especially in general practice, like a rushed environment. And so it's like, what's the fastest way we can get this 150 pound, you know, flailing dog to do what we want it to do? We have to lay them down. Owners might want a nail trim. I mean, the point is there's a lot of physicality to it, and people don't want you to sedate their pets every time they come in. They don't, you know, that would make our lives easier. But frankly, you still have to pick them up. I do surgery. All my patients are under anesthesia. Do you know how many times I pick up dogs in a day? Like pick them up on a table, put them back down, carry them to the radiology room. I mean, there are gurneys and things like that, but it honestly doesn't generally, that doesn't make it actually that much easier. You still have to get them from gurney to table and stuff. So there's, and I think this is probably true in human medicine on the surgery side, but they'll have like six people pick up a person. We don't have the luxury of the staffing to have six people. So it's like, for me, if I can, I pick up the dog by myself. And sometimes it's a struggle, and I know techs that do that and stuff like that. And it's really a probably a female dominated industry at this point as well. And so, not to say that all women are weaker than all men, but in general, size wise, it's a lot of small, and so that's, there's a lot of component to that that is very true. And so thinking about it from,
and don't forget the 7 pound cat, you know, that is,
a tiny little
thing, right. But is the most squirreliest, slippery thing that has claws and teeth. Oh, right.
Yeah. So I am far more scared of dealing with the 7-pound angry cat than 150 pound angry dog, because
lots of physicality.
The cat has 5 weapons, every set of claws and their teeth. Dogs are only going to bite you. And so if you can control their head, you're done. Like, that's it. You don't have to worry about anything else.
Right.
The cats will just keep tearing you up. I've seen it happen to people. I've seen it happen. I mean, I've had minor things with cats, but they are limber.
Yeah.
And I mean, they will fight. So it's, we don't need to necessarily get into a whole discussion on handling fractious animals and stuff. But the point is, it is a physical job. And probably not looked at it from that perspective from the outside world, but as a physical job, I can count on one hand the number of old technicians I know. It just people leave, people go, because you just can't do it anymore. And it's very uncommon for like people in their 50s and 60s to be veterinary technicians still. It's truly, and when I say old, I say that respectfully. I'm nearly 50 myself. So being a technician, I think, is a young person's career or a, you know, job description. And a lot of them do exactly what you did and saw, like move into management. I've seen a lot of technicians leave veterinary space and go to human nursing, different avenues, but ultimately, I wanted to kind of point that out. The other thing that you talked about that I think is like hugely important to keep talking about is the comfort level with money and just discussing it, because you're 100% spot on. Like, people are this is not just in veterinary world. This is like, people are afraid to talk about money. It comes from our backgrounds. It comes from, you know, for whatever reason. So I wanted to ask you first, Why were you comfortable with it? What, like, I would say 90% of people are just not comfortable talking about money.
Yeah.
In general, yeah. Not just in the veterinary world, but
I think American society at large, right? It's just not normal for us to talk about money in a purely transactional sense. We add a lot of value to money that is intangible. We have a lot of societal beliefs on what, you know, that money equals some moral characteristic. And specifically to veterinary medicine, that is so different from human medicine, is we get told, you know, directly or indirectly a lot, that we're here to heal, and we should be doing it because out of the goodness of our heart and our soul, and we're providing, you know, a service to that client and to that pet because we should be doing it. We should be doing it out of goodwill, and it's supposed to make us better people. And that's kind of the identity that holds us back, because then it makes it much harder for us to have conversations where we do have to talk about profitability and the transaction of money for services and the value of, you know, the intellectual professionalism that our team brings, you know, like you mentioned earlier about the physicality of veterinary medicine. AI is not going to replace that. AI is not going to move the dog from one part of the hospital to the other. Yeah. And same thing with how we're able to deliver medicine. There are only so many things that can be automated and computerized in our profession. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's that component of the expectation from within our team, as well as from the public, that says, you know, you should be doing this not for money, not for profit, you know, feel happy that you're saving a life or improving a life.
Yeah.
That's a pretty hard line to walk every day and still be a business owner and still be a leader in a medical practice that delivers a service, but also is an employer.
Right. Right. No, it's so true. You know, you really hit it on the head, because it's you said within the team, as well as, you know, externally in the public, like truly the expectation is that we should do what we do because we love animals. Mm-hmm. And we do. And we do what we do because we love animals. Oh, by the way, at an extreme discount to the same medicine that's happening in human medicine and other, you know, people generally don't know what they're actually paying for their own medical care, but here's an example. So I have, this was back in the fall, I had strep throat, which is a weird thing to get as an adult, I guess. Got strep throat. I called my doctor. They did not let me come in. So I had to go I sat in my car, and someone came out and did like the swab, like the strep throat test. And then I left. That was it. That was my whole, like, that was my doctor's visit. I left, and they called me and were like, it's positive. We'll call in your prescription for antibiotics. Okay, great. Don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem with how this happened. I was totally fine to not go in and sit down and talk to someone. It was a $368 consultation to have my throat swabbed in the parking lot. And it was, the test is what the test is. Like, most of the lab tests are kind of the same in human and veterinary medicine, because they're a lot of times run in similar labs or sister labs. But that consult was $368. And then I went through my course of antibiotics, and it came back. I got strep throat again, like 3 days later, called. Had a teleconsult with a physician's assistant, who told me, I said, I have strep throat again. Like, the antibiotics have been gone for 3 days, whatever it was. I was like, this is how things work. Like, maybe it's a resistant or whatever. She argued with me, wouldn't do that. Wouldn't do anything. Wouldn't give me more antibiotics. I got charged another $368 consult for that one. 3 days later, I was like, this is just getting worse. Can we maybe, if you need me to do another test before you'll prescribe antibiotics, fine. Came back to the parking lot, got swabbed again, $368 plus the test fee again. Guess what? I had a resistant strain of strep throat. Right. Like,
that's like where you're like, why did you not culture it from the get-go, right? Right?
Like I knew. I knew the answer. I knew I had strep throat again. I knew what it was. Mm-hmm. I told her what it was. She argued with me. So that whole thing was like, I don't know, $2,000 between lab tests and you know, these consults that they're calling it. And I'm just like, that's fine. But if we did that, it would be like plastered all over social media. Terrible.
You didn't get the value out of those 2-3 visits that equated to $300 a pop, right?
Yeah.
And we strive so hard in veterinary medicine to deliver the value for not only the cost, but also the time. Like, if we talk about asking the team to go from 20-minute appointment times to 15-minute appointment times, and they're like, oh no, like, well, how can you increase prices for your exam fees and reduce the appointment block? And, you know, internally we have that conflict of being able to convey value that it's not exactly equal to the time. There are multiple components to the professional input that goes into it. How do we, you know, how do we still provide that optimal experience to the client, where the client feels heard, but also be able to deliver the medicine to the patient, who's, in our world, those are two separate entities.
Right. We're actually treating two different beings. We're treating an owner and we're treating a pet. That's the reality. It's like every single consult, treatment protocol, whatever it is, you are treating two different beings, and you're treating one medically, you're treating another one as a maybe a therapist, a support system, you know what I mean? There's whatever you want to call it. I assume it's like this being a being a pediatrician, but also like you're not expected to be a pediatrician for free. So I just don't like people don't say you should be a pediatrician for free because you should want to help kids.
Right.
Like that's, I've never once heard someone say that, like, but we get told that daily, at least. Like, it's very common to be, you know, to have pushback over, charging for services and pricing and stuff with the, that same like montage of some variation of you should do this just because you love animals. And it's very disheartening, I think is really what it comes down to. It's just over time, it does weigh on you. And I think especially for new grads, maybe people early in their career, before they have built up the confidence, two things, built up the confidence to feel 100%, you know, sure of themselves and in what recommendations they're making and things like that. The other thing is efficiency. Like new grads, I was the same, like when you come out, you're very, very slow. And so, especially in general practice, they come out with these, you know, what, 20, 30 minute appointments, if you're lucky, and you're expected to talk to the client, get a history, do a physical exam, diagnose the patient and treat it in that amount of time. And also you shouldn't really charge much for it. Like that's kind of the expectation. And it's not really a fair expectation for people to put on the veterinarians. So anyway, we've digressed a little bit because I really do want to talk about you. And so you started talking to people about their financial statements. How are they, you know, you started asking questions. And I think, you know, you said, you want the title of this episode to be Curiosity Doesn't Kill the Cat. And I think that probably ties in very well here to kind of the idea of your willingness to ask questions around money.
Yeah.
How did you, I'm sure people were initially, probably some people were put off by those questions because it's not the norm, but how did you develop that comfort level and sort of approach those types of situations?
I think there was two different factors. One, there was opportunities where the person who was in that conversation with me had a catastrophic event of some sort where money was heavily impacting, you know, their livelihood or their practice singularly, or a combination of also their personal life. And so I think there was a breaking point where they're like, I don't know what to do, where to go next. You know, I don't know how to unravel this. And I was willing to step in and say, let's learn together, you know? So there was that component. And I think for myself personally, I did not grow up in a household where my parents talked very openly about money. And so there was, instead of for myself, I'm not quite sure why, but instead of shying away from it, I think I wanted to know more because I wanted to be able to control that one aspect of my life. So when I went off to UCLA, you know, it was like, great, sign me up for financial aid and the work study program. And now I know I have a paycheck coming in, you know, and I've got to figure out a budget on how to pay for things, because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to rely on my parents to be like an endless piggy bank, you know. So I think there's some aspect of maybe my intrinsic need to have some control. And then when I see somebody that is in a state of chaos, panic, like I mentioned earlier, embarrassment, you know, any combination of those things, like that's where my inner social worker comes out. it doesn't come out very often, but that's where I go, ooh, I can help you with that, you know, like, or I can be the confidant that can listen to that portion of your life, not judge you, and figure out, okay, let's triage this. And that's kind of like a little bit of where I got my emergency medicine skills from, was like, how do you, you're always triaging like the new information that's coming in and the new variable that's being thrown onto the table, right? So I think a lot of that was opportunity and just not being scared of confronting it. And a lot of, and the motivation was less for myself directly, but more for, you're somebody in need. You know, I think I can help you.
Yeah. And make no mistake, this is needed throughout the veterinary community. We don't go to school to become business people. It's just not, there's not time. That's the reality of it is I think two factors. One, most veterinarians don't want to be business people until they suddenly own a practice because they don't like the business person who's not a business person that they work for. Like, it's just, the solution often to, you know, an unpleasant work environment is, I can do better than that. I'll go open my own practice. And then it turns out exactly the same, because the actual root of the problems that cause that initial practice to be a problem is often just carried on to the next one, because people are not asking the questions, not learning how to run a business, how to keep their finances straight, all the things that you focused on. It's really fascinating. I went to just a 1-day event on Saturday, and it was a lot about this, not in the veterinary world, but it was a lot about people's fears and misconceptions of how money works and all the things that we do that we're taught are as like the norm, and how wrong those norms are if you actually want to build wealth and have financial freedom. And a lot of it comes from an unwillingness to talk about and just to be comfortable with the topic. And you said it earlier, you said, you know, we don't ask people how much they make. Right. They brought this up at that conference. The guy was like, I mean, these guys are like, they're like, I don't know if they're billionaires, but like very, very wealthy, tremendous amount of business success. But they made the point. It was like, I hang out with other people who talk about money, so I talk about money. It's like what you surround yourself with. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the stigma around that's greed and stuff, but it's like, go to one of these conferences and see what they're doing. See what they're doing with that money. If you think having money is a bad thing, then you're not thinking about what you could do with that money to help others. That's the reality is if you're looking at it from a negative connotation. Like, my favorite thing about the conferences that I go to in the real estate and finance world are to hear about people's foundations and what they've, like, what good they've done when they've reached that, you know, high earner stage, because that's what I want. And so if I see other people have done it, and guess what? For you other medical professionals, those people didn't get through med school. You're smart enough to do it. You have the drive to do it. Like, you already spent, you know, 4, 8, sometimes 12 years training to do what you do now. You can do this. Like, anyone can do this. The most of the people that have done this in the business world, they probably, from a pure intelligence level, may not be at the level of a doctor, right? They may not have that, but it doesn't matter, because one of the points of this conference was they're talking about like money is a game, and most people are playing by the wrong set of rules.
Yeah.
And so understanding what the rules are to get to where you need to be. And that can be on a smaller scale in your veterinary practice. That can be on a large scale if you're, you know, buying multi-million dollar companies.
I see so many parallels with in veterinary medicine that we can actually leverage off of. And maybe it's just a lack of looking at this perspective, but like, as a veterinary professional, you know, medical team member, whether you're the technician or the veterinarian, like, you know what your minimum database needs to be, right? You know, you have a SOAP you need to write, and you're going to come up with your differentials, and you're going to come up with your therapeutics. And it is now very common for us to talk about multimodal approaches, right? There's no more like one penicillin shot anymore, right? So that's the same thing with your finances. Like, know what your baseline is. Know what, at minimum, what your take-home salary is going to be. And then add on a couple other things like, okay, I've got this benefits package over here that does this. I've got a 401k, you know, I've got an HSA plan. And, I also have some PTO days. That's actually monetized by your employer. And then figure out what your action plan is going to be. You know, decide where do you think you're going to be spending that money? You got your student loan debt you got to pay off. You've got a rent or a mortgage to pay. You know, all these little things that take away from your revenue stream. And then what do you have left? Do you have something left? What are you going to do with that? And you're going to be able to capitalize on it, where you're investing in something that is going to grow independently of you just replenishing that bucket, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, medical professionals, especially in veterinary medicine, we're already trained to think in this, in these steps of decision making, you know, gathering the information and then make a decision and follow through on your action plan. Why can't we do this with our finances, especially, you know, with our business? And I think going back to you mentioning, you know, the new grad that's going to be slower and or the team that is saying like, hey, like, you're telling me to sell more product. You know, I feel like a salesman if I'm gonna go in there and talk to this client about this treatment plan, but it's a financial estimate for services. You know, when we break down with our team, with our new grads, you know, with our seasoned veterinarians, anybody on the team, and you say, hey, this reference lab costs us, yes, you can look it up in the PIMS, it costs us $50 to run that lab. Well, we're not going to run it for $50 because I need you to collect the blood and I need you to help hold the animal, like all these different layers. And then on top of that, we've got like a building, you know, with a roof over your right. head and the right. lights are on. So all these different factors come into play and they're like, okay, so that's why, you know, a $50 lab is being sold at $200-$250 to the client. And you're like, oh, you're price gouging our clients. I was like, well, no, let's factor in everything in. Once we pay for all these other things that contribute to our ability to send that one lab out, we're not making a lot of profit.
Yeah. Yeah. The lab samples don't collect themselves and put themselves in a box and send themselves to the lab mm-hmm. and then interpret the results for the owner when it comes back. Like there's so many things that, you know, kind of get left out of the picture. And it's like, I hear this unfortunately far too often, and I have said it myself. So I'm not saying that where, you know, you can point to a lab like that and you can say, okay, there's a reason we have to, you know, X multiple on what it costs us for that. And you can point to all those things. And then I'll hear people say, oh, but we can do this surgery for less for this person because all it is my time. All it is my time. And I'm like, it makes me sick. I'm like, that is the most important thing you have.
Yes, like, yes.
All it is your time. That is literally the most important thing that you have. Mm-hmm. And it should be the thing you value the most. And so many times we say, all it is my time. And it's like, okay, first of all, if that were actually true, that all it is your time. No, it's your time. It's the technician's time. It's the anesthesia and the material, like the things that go into getting something into anesthesia mm-hmm. and doing a surgery. second of all, it's your time. It's not just your time. It's the time that you're not spent doing other things as well. If you want to look at it from a pure revenue standpoint, if you're like, I can do this because it's just my time, I can do it for free or at a discount or whatever. Well, you're not only doing that for free, you're not generating any other revenue while you're doing that, or you're not with your family.
Yeah.
Right? Those are the two things. You're either not actually making money another way, or you're not with your family, or doing something that you deserve to enjoy. And mm-hmm. it's just this, it's a really, like I said, I've said it more than once. I'll probably say it again, even, right? Like, it's just, but it recognizing those things, from within, that it's not just the pushback from, you know, the public or the clients or whatnot. It is also from within, and it's, you know, you're as a veterinarian, your colleagues, your technicians, your front desk staff, they're going to ask you to do things for free too. It's not just going to be the clients, and it should be my choice if I want to do something for free.
Well, in addition to the time element, and I'll double down on this, it's the expertise, it's the knowledge that you have gained over time, and your ability to be efficient with your time, right? So you can do that surgery and it'll take you 3 hours, and maybe you are willing to give up your time, or there can be another surgeon that can do it in 1.5 hours, right? You know, so there's, and it's more than just, oh, that was a faster procedure, but there was an efficiency aspect to it. There's a safety component to it, you know, that increases for the humans that are in the OR, as well as the patient that's under anesthesia on that table. Yeah. So, you know, the professional knowledge that we bring in is rarely monetized. And because it's hard to put a number on it, but that is where
Aren't hard to put a number on. There's quite a hefty number on that for myself and quite frankly, other newer grads are far worse than mine, but you can put a number on it. I mean, you extract the time from it, so many people have, you know, debilitating levels of student debt that you're still paying for. So it's just like valuing your time and just saying it's just my time is just like, you're right. Like, there's a million things that go into it in the expertise. I mean, between vet school and my residency and my internship, that was 8 years of my life to become a surgeon. 8 years, the first 4 years of the time I was paying. The second 4 years of that, I was making just barely enough to survive. Like, just to have a place and eat sometimes. Like, that's how that looks. And so I mean, I'm not alone in that. Like, you're giving up a portion of your life to get to this point where you should be able to be compensated for your time and expertise. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So, talk to me about practice ownership. We talked about this before. I really loved the way that you kind of laid out some of the generational differences that you've seen and perceive in the veterinary community as far as practice ownership. So you have, you know, that's a route that people can take when they get out of vet school. I would say not a lot of people go immediately into practice ownership, but it's not an uncommon goal. Tell us a little bit about your take on that.
It's evolved quite a bit, right? I think over even just within the last 20 years, we've seen the demographics of practice owners change quite a bit. And love it, hate it, neutral, consolidators are a huge component of that. So having, you know, a big chunk of the market being taken out of the independent practice ownership, you know, we have to recognize that's here to stay in one form or another. So if we just, and there's so many different aspects of consolidators and that business model that is way more complex to unravel. So we'll kind of put that on the side. But just for the independent practice owners, you know, I think a lot of baby boomers are now at a stage where they're looking for retirement, you know, but they may have they may have unknowingly diversified their portfolio, right? Because they opened up a practice because they're a veterinarian, but they were given a very lucrative opportunity to also purchase the real estate that their practice sits upon. So now when they go to sell their practice to whatever entity it is, they actually have two different businesses alone, you know, just to start, that they can really leverage off of. That is not necessarily the case for another set of practice owners that came in much later in the game, you know, and there are a lot of the Gen Xers that are that practice medicine, and maybe were even able to open up their practice or buy a book of business from a retiring vet. There, a lot of them, at least in the metro areas, they're in strip malls, you know. That piece of land is owned by some other property management company, and their lease agreements look very different. You know, it's, first it was, oh, you have a triple net lease and you've got a lot of additional responsibilities. And then now, you know, they now have leases where it's tied into a part of your revenue. You know, like your property manager just automatically gets a percentage of your revenue. So it's like, well, why should I? Sometimes it's kind of like, why should I work that hard to increase my profitability if I already know like a certain percentage is going to go to just, you know, who owns this piece of land in the parking lot, you know? So it doesn't surprise me that as our millennial veterinarians that came into the workforce, you know, graduating from school, and they said, just give me a W-2 job, you know, just sign me up. Let me just kind of essentially clock in, clock out, you know, without wanting to really invest into a longer term plan. Their value systems were very different, you know. Again, love it or hate it in terms of how you characterize millennials as a generation, and where their motivations are. They're just a different beast in terms of, you know, what they see as their current priorities and their long term priorities. And then now we have Gen Xer, Gen Zers coming into the workforce. You know, they're coming through now, and we're not quite sure where they're going to land in terms of practice ownership. I think that we'll see a resurgence in independent practice owners because of this influx of millennials not really collectively looking into owning a business. And I think that Gen Zers have had a different set of life experiences that they're looking for a little bit more autonomy, a lot more control, right? So just like fashion and hairstyles, you know, it's cyclical, right? You know, but we do have to recognize that even Gen Zers, they're not going to be able to afford the piece of land that's underneath their practice. And maybe they're business partnership is going to look very different because the price of entry into a practice ownership, that's much higher these days, you know, so they're looking at partnering with another veterinarian or bringing on, you know, a manager that also has some equity into it. I think that those are just different opportunities that I find very exciting because there's less cookie cutting. But at the same time, the process of going to your bank and getting a small business loan, you used to be able to just show your diploma and say, hey, I'm a veterinarian. I've got this awesome skill, you know, that is very easily needed in a community space and monetized. Give me a business loan. Now those banks, they've learned that the veterinary industry, you know, is from one perspective, a money-making machine. And from another perspective, it can be a volatile investment, you know. Mm-hmm. So just like anything else, now they're asking a lot of questions, more than just how much money do you want to take from us. It's like, well, what is your 3-year plan? You know, what are you going to be able to generate in revenue? Do you understand your local market, competitive market landscape? You know, how are you going to set yourself apart? We want to see your expenses. We want to see your anticipated revenue streams. Now that barrier to entry to be a business owner as a veterinarian, now there's more challenges, right? You don't have access to purchase the land for the most part. You don't have a low monetary, threshold to make. You need to take out $1 million, versus $200,000 as, whatever that big jump is. And on top of that, you're going to be scrutinized. You're going to really need to understand how you're going to be able to finance this loan. And that can be really intimidating.
Well, and I think it makes the argument for kind of what we started with in the beginning is that you can no longer get by not knowing this stuff. You can no longer just say, I'm not going to know about finances. I'm not going to know. First of all, the information is everywhere. Like, it's not hard to find. It's not hard to learn about it anymore. You have to find, some trusted people. You have to go to the right sources, but like, it's everywhere. Like, there's a million different ways to find out about finances. And because these banks are going to look closer, if you're thinking about practice ownership, or even if you're not, you still need to look at like, what's my financial future going to look like? But you need to learn some of those questions that get asked. You need to learn, what is a budget? What does it mean? Like, what is my exit strategy? What is my business plan? And again, that's whether you're owning the business or going to work for someone. Like, just taking whatever job you can take is maybe fine when you first get out of school, but like, you need to look at what's going to set you up for the long term.
Hey there, I am Dr. Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast, where we explore the why behind success. Every week, I meet with real estate investors, veterinary entrepreneurs, mindset coaches, authors, and fitness professionals to uncover their why and how it drives them on the winding road to success. What is your why?